Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we have a great opportunity to visit with Stan Temple. He is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison, a Senior Fellow in the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and here to talk about the effects of climate and weather on seasonal events and to tell us about the 2020 phenology calendar, which I look forward to getting every year. I hope you'll become a part of the conversation as we visit with Stan. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Do you follow phenology, the seasons? Questions about it? Maybe you got a question about the birds and wildlife that you track when you track their behavior. I know we'll talk a bit about behavior with Stan as well. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Stan Temple, welcome back.
It's good to be here, Larry.
Good to have you. We usually interchange, or oftentimes I think the words weather and climate are interchanged, and there is a big difference between the two.
There is, and phenology, how things happen during the calendar year, is a good way to understand the difference between them. There's a catchy phrase that says, climate is what you expect, and weather is what you get. And it's a matter of a time scale. When we talk about climate, we're talking about the conditions over a long period of time, years and decades of time, the average. So when you watch the evening weather forecast, they'll tell you what the long-term average was. And then they tell you what you're going to get, which is the weather, which can be highly variable from day to day, even hour to hour. So for plants and animals, this presents a challenge for them. They obviously have to adapt themselves to the long-term climatic changes that happen on the planet Earth.
Yeah.
But they also have to be nimble enough to respond to the short-term weather that they get. So we see lots of examples of species of plants and animals that illustrate this in ways that your average listener can probably observe. Right now, for example, we've got about 14,000 sandhill cranes that are staging on the Wisconsin River right behind Aldo Leopold's shack. And they were motivated to go there basically by climate. On average, they know it's time to leave home and head to the river to fatten up for migration because of the long-term average conditions. But when they actually choose to leave and start flying south, is weather dependent. They want a tailwind, and that usually in the fall and winter comes with a high pressure system that has north winds and clearing skies.
Yeah.
And once the river freezes and the corn gets buried with snow, the first weather system that comes through, they're off.
Boom, they're gone.
They're gone, yeah. So it's nice to see, you know, that they're adapted to the climate, but at the same time, they've got the plasticity to be able to respond to the short-term weather effects.
Our great engineer, Dave Potratz, has some sounds of the sandhills in the background. And I got to imagine that 14,000 sandhills.
It's very noisy, Larry.
Create a symphony.
Yeah, it's a cacophony, I think, more than a symphony. But, the Aldo Leopold Foundation offers tours for the public to come and see this phenomenon, which is, of course, something that Aldo Leopold, who's considered something of the iconic figure in American phenological studies, he could never have imagined, because back in the 30s when he was at the shack, there were only a few dozen cranes in Wisconsin, so they've really recovered.
And he really kept very detailed phenological records, did he not?
He did, and that is largely the basis for the phenology calendar that the Aldo Leopold Foundation produces every year. We have Aldo Leopold's historical records from the 30s and 40s, which is a great sort of reference point for us to see how plants and animals are responding to climate change, which, of course, has happened since Leopold's time. And it gives us a reference point, essentially, and we can see how various species are responding. And one of the things that's obvious when we look at the 300 species that Leopold monitored, it was incredible that he could monitor that many plants and animals. But one of the things that we find is that some species are responding to climate change, and often that means whatever the event was, whether it's a flowering or a migration or whatever, is happening earlier because things are warmer. But at the same time, there are other species that don't seem to be able to respond. And often those species that can't respond are starting to get into trouble because of their inability to adapt to the changing climate. And part of that is because the climate's changing so fast that it's much faster than their ability to adapt.
In your mind, are there, I mean, maybe you don't even want to talk about some of the species that may be in that kind of situation, but care to comment on?
Oh, yeah, and it shows up in the phenology calendar, and we talk about it this year. One difference that many people who are bird watchers would recognize is that our short-distance migrants, the birds that leave Wisconsin in the winter but really don't go that far, they go hundreds of miles at winter in the U.S., they just seem to be able to respond really well to the changing climate. So many of them are coming back much earlier, and some of them, like robins, they're not even leaving anymore because our winters have gotten so mild. But when you think about the long-distance migrants, the ones that go all the way down to the Neotropics, to Central America and South America, for them, they aren't responding to our climate here at all. They are timing their migration by day length, and that doesn't change over time.
Yeah.
And as a result, they're arriving back in Wisconsin at the same time that you could say they always have, or at least that they have for many, many decades. And that puts them sort of behind the eight ball in competition with the species that have gotten here quicker, earlier, because they are responding to the changing climate.
And they may be coming back to a situation where that isn't right for them then.
Well, that's right. They're late. They're late to the show. So maybe the food supply that the long-term perspective they were anticipating would be available might have already passed. So you're right. It's a problem for some species.
Stan Temple, our guest today, emeritus professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, talking phenology with him today. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions, comments, or maybe your own observations. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Bob, you've got a great photo, wildlife photo, outdoor photo. We'd love to see that as well. You can send a question and or photo to ideas@wpr.org. Stan and I can take a look and make a comment on those photos and those questions as well as we visit with him today. So how long – so does it – take a while? Obviously, it's taken a while for some species to adapt. But the short-term birds, for example, were able to adapt pretty quickly.
I think the difference, for example, with these migratory birds is that the short-distance migrants that stay essentially in the U.S., they are experiencing North America's climate. Whereas if you're a long-distance migrant and you're spending the winter in Costa Rica, you're not experiencing the North American climate, so you can't really respond to it when you decide to come north in the spring. So you time your migration by day length. And, you know, that's constant from year to year, and we haven't found a way to screw that up yet. We probably will eventually, but at least for now, it's something that's pretty stable from year to year.
Well, we'll take some calls. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. But before we do go to the phones, I look forward to the phenology calendar every year, and I hope there are lots of calendars out there available for folks.
There are. We're stocked up and ready to go. We know that this calendar is extremely popular. It's a very attractive calendar with lots of nice wildlife photographs. But more than that, it's very informative. Yeah. Month by month, day by day, you can sort of peek in on what you might expect Here's climate again. What you might expect based on our long-term climate records of when events will occur. It might not occur on that date because of the weather, but we also, each month, we have a little essay that talks about something that's happening that month and interprets it. This year, the theme, as you said, is climate and weather. So each month, we pick one event that's going to happen that month and describe how climate and weather are affecting the date on which you might expect to see it.
And, you know, I guess the thing I like the best, I was tempted. Well, once I tried to just sit down and read them all, and it's more fun to read them each month as they come up.
It is. I agree 100%. Yeah. So the calendars are now available.
Yeah. How do we get them?
It's pretty easy. If you go to the Alda Leopold Foundation website, the first thing that pops up is the link to ordering the calendar. So aldoleopold.org, very easy. aldoleopold.org, and you can buy your calendar for $15, includes shipping, and have it in time for Christmas. Doesn't quite fit in a stocking, but you can have it in time for Christmas, which I think a lot of people do give them away as gifts.
Yeah, and often I bet there are a lot of orders of two or three.
Yes.
One for me and one for you, kind of a thing.
Yeah, and over the years we've learned... Larry, I think you're one of our best sales assets because we get a big rush of orders after I'm on your show.
Well, that's good. I'm glad because it's a great calendar. And again, so it's Aldo. What's the
aldoleopold.org.
aldoleopold.org. So write that down or maybe just click on there right now and order your copies.
Yep.
There we go. Well, lots of people to visit with you. So let's go to the phones. Dale and Barron, we'll go to you. Hi, Dale.
Hi, good morning, Larry. I really enjoy your show. I watch almost every day, or I listen almost every day.
Thank you.
I taught environmental science at the university level, and I had my students do a phenology exercise. And it was common at the beginning of a semester, I'd hear groans and, like, students saying, what are we doing here? This doesn't sound like any fun at all. And by this semester, they loved it. I had so many students who said that was so much fun. I saw so many things that they've always been there, but I never noticed them before until I had to look. And so I really hope that the Aldo Leopold Foundation and other organizations can really push the phenology in our schools, because it is a good way to get students engaged in the environment.
And Dale, that's a really good segue into how did Aldo Leopold get into the almost obsessive habit of keeping phenological records? And it dates back to his grade school days in Burlington, Iowa. Back in the late 19th century, there was an early, I guess today we might say, environmental education program called the Nature Study Movement. And it incurred, they produced lesson plans and distributed those to student or to teachers around the country. And the lesson plans were designed to, and just as you did, Dale, get the students out of the classroom, get them out into nature, observing things, and most importantly, taking notes or recording what they were seeing, and then come back into the classroom and try to make sense of it all. And Leopold started doing that at age 8. And literally did it until hours before he died in 1948. His little pocket notebook that he noted things down that was in his pocket when he died of a heart attack in April of 1948, the last written words were a phenological observation of bloodroot blooming.
Oh, man. Dale, have you ever heard back from former students who have kept it up?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have. I had several students who kept it up. One in particular told me 3 years after having my semester class was still doing the phenology exercise because he loved it so much and noticed the things around them so much. And I had interesting things like one student recorded seeing a shark, and I'm like, what? And they were doing it while on spring break. And it was near, obviously, by the ocean, and was still thinking about their phonology assignment. And so, yes, I have had students respond.
Dale, thank you so much.
Yeah, and of course, today it's a lot easier than it was in Leopold's time because there are several citizen science projects around the country that will allow you to upload your observations to a central database, so you don't even have to write it down on paper. You can just upload it immediately.
But I like with the calendar, you've got some things you can people write right in the calendar, don't they?
Oh, I think they do, and they often remind us. You know, they said, you know, you said it was going to happen on this date, and this year it happened a week earlier, and of course it was a short-term weather impact on the date.
Well, Dale, again, thank you. Cindy in Belleville will give you a chance. Hi, Cindy.
Thanks, Larry. I have a quick observation to share with you. I live in southern Dane County, not far from the Sugar River, and over the past 2 to 3 years that we've had such extreme wet weather in this area, I believe I've noticed more bald eagles near me flying overhead, which in past years I've never noticed in this area. I had one incident in particular just last week when I had a predator bird swoop through my around my house, scaring all the birds from the feeders. And it actually took, this bird actually took a dove, which, of course, is quite a heavy catch. And when I consulted my bird books, I believe it was a juvenile bald eagle that came through. So you just mentioned, Stan, you just mentioned the Citizen Science Project, so I wanted to put in a quick plug for eBird, which is a Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Citizen Science Project where people can enter their birding observations. Thanks.
Thank you, Cindy.
And Cindy, most people don't remember or realize that eBird had a predecessor, a model, which was the Wisconsin Checklist Project that I started back in the 1970s. I'm a graduate of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and for years encouraged them to pick up what we were doing in Wisconsin and take it nationally. And fortunately, I think logistically, they delayed until the technology was available for people to upload it so that they didn't have to fill out forms and mail them in or do something else that was kind of clunky. But eBird is the 300-pound gorilla of citizen science, and it's just remarkable. For migratory birds, for example, they analyze the data in real time, so you can actually go online and see where the migrant birds are and sort of anticipate when they're going to arrive in Wisconsin.
Thank you again, Cindy, for calling. Charles in Hayward will give you a chance now. Hi, Charles.
Hi there. I've noticed that that the robins are back sooner and even the sandhill cranes at times, but the ruby-throated hummingbirds up here in Hayward, they come back within a day or two of Mother's Day. And they leave within a day or two of Labor Day.
Yeah.
and they do it every year. Is that going to put them in danger because they're down in South America and not paying attention to our weather?
Well, you're right. They're long-distance migrants. So as I said earlier, it is exactly the problem that they face, that their migration is being timed by photo period. I'm not aware, actually, that hummingbirds have had a problem because of that. The problem that they would run into, and one that other long-distance migrants do, is when they arrive on the breeding ground, they almost immediately begin nesting, and they need insects to feed their young. The young need minerals and protein to grow, and although we think of hummingbirds as feeding on nectar, when they're raising their young, insects are really important. So if their delay in getting to Wisconsin because of their tie to photo period results in them missing a critical hatch of insects, it could impact them.
Thanks very much for calling, Charles. Appreciate your call. Bill in Waukesha, we'll get to you in just a second, but I want to remind you as you listen in today, our guest today is Stan Temple, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison, and a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, talking with him about phenology today and the great phenology calendar that his organization puts out every single year. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email your photos and questions to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at phenology with our guest today, Stan Temple. It's great to have him back, and thank you so much for joining in as we talk phenology with him. We have Bill in Waukesha with a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, I used to live on Okatchee Lake, and there's this guy, Ray Schrader. He was about 90-some years old. And he used to show me pictures and stuff in the newspaper of him, and he had some thing where he used the moon to predict the different migration patterns, and I'm not sure exactly. I just wondered if you guys had ever heard of Ray Schrader, and I'll take a listen off air.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. I have not.
I have not either, but if I was going to try to make myself legendary in predicting when birds were going to migrate, I don't think I'd be looking at the moon. I think I'd be looking at weather fronts. And certainly now we have enough knowledge about what weather conditions stimulate birds to actually start moving, that you can predict a day or two ahead of time when there's a cold front approaching Wisconsin. And you can be sure in the fall that means when the passage of that front means that there are going to be a lot of birds migrating. But it's absolutely the reverse in the spring.
Oh,
it
is.
In the spring, because remember, they want a tailwind.
Oh, sure.
So predicting in the spring, it's actually a warm front coming with south wind, tailwind,
sure,
and overcast skies. Usually when we have a south wind, we get overcast skies. So, you know, a clever person, if you want to impress your neighbors, look at the weather forecast, and you can say, yeah, keep your eyes open. There are going to be a lot of birds coming in the next few days.
And the guy that was so good at it may have been relying on phenology in a way to be, you know, over time.
That's right. If he was in his 90s.
So he'd been watching it for a long, long time.
Yeah. And, of course, if you do that over a long period of time, Aldo Leopold, for example, kept these detailed records. And he himself recognized that, yeah, there was a general pattern. There was an average date on which things happened. But from year to year, there was a bit of variation that he could explain essentially by weather.
Yeah, there we go. Jim in Camp Douglas. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a couple of comments here, and then I'll take your feedback off air. I was a natural resources major student at UW-Stevens Point in the 80s, and Vince High, an ornithologist, was one of my professors. Mm-hmm. And he came in one day, and giving a lecture, he was yawning all the time. So I couldn't help but find out when he got done why he was so tired. And he told me he was out picking up dead birds underneath cable TV towers the night before so that they could take them in for research and do this and do that. So my question is, what effect have these windmills and these, well, now we've got more cell phone towers out there than we did back in the 80s. What effect has that had on some of the populations that might find themselves flying into them during migration time? So I'll take my your comments offline. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Well, you're right, Jim. It's during migration that these structures can cause problems for some migratory birds. And the ones that cause the most problems are the really tall radio and television towers that get up to the altitude where birds are migrating. And the way that they cause a problem is often that they have lots of guide wires that are holding them up, and the birds simply can't see those and run into those wires. The other thing that we now know is that the lighting on some of those tall towers, especially on an overcast, foggy night, can confuse birds. And when they get confused and fly around those tall towers, they hit the guide wires. And that's what Vince High was doing. He was actually collecting birds under a very tall television tower. Cell phone towers tend to, of course, be much lower, and they are self-supporting. They don't have guide wires. So they are not nearly as dangerous for migrating birds as the taller transmission towers. And wind turbines, you know, they're very visible on the landscape, and there's been a lot of speculation about how much mortality they cause. But in terms of the things that birds run into, wind turbines are way down the list. Plate glass windows are far and away the biggest source of collision mortality for migratory birds. So, yeah, it's, you know, every little mortality, you know, takes its toll. But it's clearly, you know, wind towers, wind turbines are not a big deal for birds. They're a much bigger deal for bats. Bats have been shown to suffer really sort of abnormally high mortality at these wind turbines.
And thanks again, Jim, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, 800-642-1234. Give us a call with your question or comment. Janet in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. In Madison, we had snow in late October, and it seemed like the leaves just stayed on the trees after that for weeks. They just sat, and many of them were green, and they've only just recently fallen. I almost missed that. But I wondered if our perception was right that the leaves got interrupted in falling and turning colors, and what impact would that have?
Oh, you're absolutely right, Janet. This was a really unusual year. Yeah. That cold snap early happened much earlier than most of our native trees form the abscission layer that lets leaves drop. So the temperature got cold enough to actually kill the leaf, but not cause the abscission to happen. So those leaves that were green were still holding on to a lot of the vital nutrients that normally the tree would have sort of sucked out of the leaves and taken back down into the roots. But this early cold snap prevented that from happening. So you're absolutely right. A lot of green leaves stayed on, and it was only much later that they fell. And I know for a lot of people, they're kind of saying, well, all the leaves fell after the city does its leaf collection. So they've kind of got a mess in their yard to deal with. But it was an unusual year. And, of course, that's a weather phenomenon rather than a climate-related phenomenon.
Just last weekend, it happened to be a warm day, and I and a lot of my neighbors were out there getting the remainder of the leaves off the lawn. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Amy in Appleton emailed that she enjoys watching many finch varieties feed at her bird feeders, and there's a noticeable decline in their numbers when it gets cold, especially in goldfinches, and she wonders if they go south.
Yeah, goldfinches, sort of the population is divided. Some of them are short-distance migrants and will wander south of Wisconsin, and others will stick with us for the entire winter. So you will see a drop-off as the birds that are going to go south depart. The other thing that happens with finches, of course, is that northern finches that nest up in Canada and the North Woods, for them, Wisconsin is the winter habitat. So yeah, they're coming to Wisconsin to spend the winter. So a phenological event that many people look forward to is the arrival of some of the northern finches. So things like dark-eyed juncos and purple finches that are bird feeder birds that come to the feeder are often a sort of a signal of the changing season. And especially juncos, because they're very common and most people recognize the juncos. You know, they sort of think of them as the harbinger of winter when they start arriving.
Bob emailed a photo, and I don't know, you can probably take a look at it. It's a photo of a fresh meat hole that he came across on the Mississippi floodplain just today.
Yeah.
Is this the behavior of a raccoon?
Well, I suppose it's possible. It looks pretty muddy there, Bob, but I wonder whether you could see any tracks around it. And it's kind of hard from the photo to get a scale. Raccoons normally don't cache things like that. So often it's another predator that will cache things. And at least in Wisconsin, the one animal that is pretty notorious for caching are bobcats. Like most cats, you know, they will kill more than they can consume in a sitting, and they'll cache the rest. Most people that have house cats are probably aware of that. When your cat, if it's, I hope not, but if it's allowed outdoors, it'll bring the excess that it kills back into the house. But this looks probably, I'm going to guess, a bobcat caching that.
William emailed to ask how migrating geese manage to stay in the V formation when flying, and how do they know which direction to fly?
Well, two important questions. First, how do they know which direction to fly? Birds, all birds that migrate, have a built-in compass that allows them to orient so they know which direction they're going. But they also need something else if they're going to migrate successfully. They have to know where they're going. Yeah. Just having a compass, if I gave you a compass and said, you know, navigate to Houston, Texas, you wouldn't have any idea how to go unless you had a map. So the birds do have a genetic map that tells them where to go. But when they're on their way, birds are always trying to make that hazardous, energy-draining, long-distance migration in the most energy-efficient way possible. And for birds that migrate in flocks, whether it's ducks or geese or sandhill cranes, if there's no wind to give them some lift, flying in a V formation makes a lot of sense, because if you are behind and just to the side of the bird in front of you, when that bird flaps its wings, it creates a wingtip vortex. Gives the bird behind just a little bit of lift, not a lot, but just enough that it helps save energy. Many people have probably, if you've been on the wing view seat on an airplane and you look out as it's taking off on a foggy or rainy day, you'll see these wingtip vortices swirling off the tip of the wing, and they go up. So it gives you a little bit of lift. But you'll find that if it's windy, the birds don't fly in the V formation, because they get much more lift from a headwind that's giving them.
Interesting. And when they're in that formation, they do switch.
Wow. They do switch. There's no leader. It just is sort of dynamic, even from minute to minute, at who happens to be in the lead.
Ruth in Eau Claire has something for us. Hi, Ruth.
Yeah, hi. Someone had called in about goldfinches, and we have sort of a haven of goldfinches in our backyard in the summer. It's incredible. But they seem to turn a darker color in the winter. I don't have a sense that they've all just gotten up and left. Is that true, that they have a darker color, or am I just imagining?
Nope. You're very observant, Ruth. They do. They molt into a non-breeding plumage, which doesn't feature that bright yellow and crisp black, and they become kind of a dull sort of olive color. But that is a molt. They replace their feathers. They lose the feathers in late fall and will be in that dull, non-breeding plumage throughout the winter. And then in the spring, if you see them coming to your feeder, you'll sort of gradually start to see birds that'll show up with a few bright yellow feathers, and pretty soon, you know, they're all yellow. And that changing of the plumage, that is a response essentially to photoperiod. So that is something that is happening on a fairly strict schedule from year to year. It depends on day length. So they molt from yellow to olive when day lengths are decreasing, and from olive to bright yellow when day length is increasing.
And Ruth, thank you so much for calling. Daniel sent a photo, an owl photo, of a snowy owl, a nice close-up shot, and we get to see a few snowy owls here in the state.
Yeah, they're one of the species from the far north that comes down to Wisconsin. It tends to be cyclic in that they come, it's about every 4 years that you'll get a movement of the birds coming out of the Arctic, and it's when the lemming populations in the Arctic, which is their main food, have crashed, and the birds will head south. And this bird in the photo is looks to me to be an adult male. And so he may be a returnee from last year. He may have already been in Wisconsin and knew where he was headed. But in a typical snowy owl invasion, the birds don't necessarily know where they're going. They're just heading south to get away from a food shortage and looking for a place where there are plenty of mice. And at least the grasslands of the Midwest are often a place that they'll stop because they're mice to eat. Yeah.
Scott emailed to ask where or what location is the phenology calendar written from or for. Yeah. For instance, the dates of migration vary from north to south with the differences in the average temperatures. He's been getting the calendar for a few years and would like to make a request. make the left-hand column containing the notes about Aldo and so forth. So there's more room for users to record their observations in the small squares with the day dates.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to squeeze it all in there. But no, you're absolutely right that the dates on which phenological events happen is not only influenced by climate and weather, it's also influenced by latitude. And there's a rule that had been figured out actually, back in the 19th century. And that is that things are delayed one day for every 15 minutes of latitude.
Oh.
So as you go further north in Wisconsin, things will be delayed by one day for every 15 minutes of latitude. So I don't know where you live, but you can probably figure out that the dates on our calendar are clearly acknowledged to be for South Central Wisconsin. But in the first page of the calendar, we have Hopkins' Law, which is this rule of thumb that you can predict the sort of offset of the timing based on latitude. So it's really easy for you to figure out how much delay it's going to be before the event in southern Wisconsin happens in northern Wisconsin.
And then if you keep the calendar going from one year to the next, eventually you'll have it just from the
observation. Yeah, you'll have it already. But it's a big difference. When you look Wisconsin, from north to south, there's about a 20-day difference between when things happen on the Illinois border and when they happen up on Lake Superior.
And again, back to the phenology calendar, that I'm looking at the 2020 calendar. I always enjoy the wonderful photos that accompany the calendar. And again, this is not an infinite resource. The calendar is kind of finite in terms of how many that are produced each year.
Yeah.
So if you want to get one,
get them while they're hot.
We do
sell out, Larry, and we do usually sell out before the end of the year. So don't delay. And we are really fortunate that we have a lot of nature photographers around the state of Wisconsin that donate their really high quality photos to the calendar, including some really unusual things. The month of February, for example, the photographer caught a woodchuck out walking around in the snow. And, of course, in the sidebar, we have the explanation of why in the world is he out there walking around the snow. And it's basically that they're down in their den hibernating, and their metabolism is really slowed down, but they're still burning that fat that they built up in preparation for the winter, which means they're producing metabolic waste. So every once in a while, an animal like a woodchuck has to wake up and come outside of its den essentially to pee. And, we have all this folklore about, Groundhog Day and everything, and the chances of seeing a groundhog above ground on Groundhog Day probably has a lot more to do with how full their bladders are rather than how long winter is going to be.
And on that note, tell us again, how do we get a copy of the calendar?
You can order it from aldoleopold.org. $15, including postage, and we'll get it to you before Christmas.
AldoLeopold.org. That's the place to go. Stan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Larry.
Always great to talk with him. I learn something every time he's on the show. I bet you do, too, and you're going to learn a lot when you take a look at the phenology calendar as well. So I hope you do that. Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And, of course, he's a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. And he has a colleague, Glenn Stanos, who is also in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And we're going to be talking with him about oak wilt and some other risks to trees. And we may even mention the Forestry Club tree sale for people who live in southern Wisconsin and near the UW-Madison campus. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.